Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm reading this current issue of Foreign Policy magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has the top 100 public intellectuals here listed.
And are you one of them?
And I'm looking for you. I can't find you. I have Daniel Dennett is on it.
Yeah.
Jared Diamond, Ann Applebaum, Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
Francis Fukuyama, Bernard Lewis, Robert Kagan, Steven Pinker, Peter Singer.
Yeah.
I don't see Bob Wright.
There's a reason for that.
Fareed Zakaria. It's
got There's a reason for that.
Got a lot of people you know, but they don't seem to have you.
Yeah.
Why is that?
You want the explanation?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not one of the top 100 public intellectuals in America. Did they not have a Central New Jersey breakout, top 100 in Central New Jersey?
I thought you were supposed to say where you are, Bob.
Oh, that's right. I'm in a bunker, an undisclosed bunker. Never mind. They didn't have a bunker breakout, the top 100 intellectuals in an undisclosed bunker. Hey, are you on that list, buddy?
They got They got some...
Are you... Mickey, hello, are you on that list?
No, but I'm a pesky blogger. But
well, so are some of those people, I think, aren't they?
Malcolm Gladwell, Christopher Hitchens. I mean, Bob, I mean, you're the founder of the Blogging Heads Empire, and you've explained not only human nature, but the course of history since the Paramecium. And yet...
Not enough. I'll have to do better next time.
You taught a course with one of them.
I did teach a course with Peter Singer. You think that would be enough, wouldn't you?
You would think that would be enough. Anyway, I just wanted to... I was hoping to, like, deflate your self-esteem so you'd be depressed.
Now, there have been other lists of public intellectuals, and don't worry, I wasn't on those either, so I'm kind of, you know... It's not like my expectations were high.
Okay.
But listen, if you show up on any of them, will you send me an email?
I will. I'll send you a marching band, yeah.
You're
not going to happen.
Send me a telegram. Well, listen, you know, here's a little news flash. This is from today's Bloomberg News. Hillary Clinton stepped up her lobbying of Democratic Party superdelegates today as her campaign aides and supporters signaled they won't compromise in the dispute over counting the Florida and Michigan primaries. Now, Mickey, what I'm wondering is whether you think it is now time to deploy the taser.
The taser on Hillary?
I think it might be for her own good.
I don't know. It seems to me that at some point, the worse she makes herself look, the better it is for Obama. And if he's going to win and he vanquishes the Glenn Close figure from Fatal Attraction, that might help him. I mean, the assumption is that if Obama says, you know, is left to his own devices to shape his message as he sees fit, that he'll be brilliant at it, and I'm not so sure. Running around the country beating up on Hillary might help him more. Plus, there's so much time. It's like there's decades.
Enjoy
of time.
The show.
Decades of time. It's not a big deal.
Don't end it prematurely with a taser. So you say no on the taser.
No on the taser.
No sort of intervention at all. Even though you confirm my judgment that it's for her own good, because you did say right. I mean, she ain't looking good.
I don't think she's looking good, but she has half of a point about Florida. So
No, I mean that's all kind of a separate issue from whether there's any point in what she's doing.
Right, she does look better. We talked about this last week. She does look better in the electoral map. I mean, Obama, the electoral map does not reflect the A, Obama's popular vote strength, and B, the Democrat strength in general. So
the point is the argument is over, right? For practical purposes,
and she
shows no awareness of that.
I think that's right. She shows some awareness of that. I mean, she's just she has not focused attacks on Obama lately. She's been focusing them on McCain. She seems to, at some level, realize that. That she has to change the tenor of her campaign. So,
I am reminded of a link you sent me to this piece that Arianna Huffington wrote that is relevant to this in the following sense.
Okay.
It makes the point that McCain, his record on abortion would alienate your average feminist big time, right?
his record, but I mean, the problem with Ariana's piece is it focuses on appearances, not the deeper reality. The if you look at McCain's record on a lot of things, he's very conservative. If you talk to McCain and talk to people who talk to McCain, he doesn't really believe any of that stuff, and nobody really is just, you know, pro forma things he says to keep the right in place. And he's not that conservative. And if you run a campaign based on the fact that McCain is this third Bush term and he's a hard right winger, look at his voting record, you're setting yourself up to lose because he can easily demonstrate in the flesh that he is not that right wing and that he's breaking with Bush. And then what do you say?
It's a good question. But before I answer it, let me insert the point I was going to make with respect to that Arianna Huffington piece, which is just that, I mean, appearances, I think, are what matter in this case in the following sense. You know, there's been a lot of talk about whether Obama has significantly alienated hardcore Democratic supporters of Hillary, who are by and large women who consider her kind of a feminist icon or something, right? And this is relevant to who he chooses for vice president. Some people say he needs to either choose her or another woman to make amends with this group. But what I hadn't really realized until I read this piece is that in the end, it's unlikely, given McCain's record on these issues of choice in abortion, it's unlikely that many feminists are going to stay at home. You know, feminists who otherwise would vote Democratic and who care about these particular issues, it seems pretty unlikely that they're going to sit on their hands in an Obama versus McCain election.
No, I think the problem with Obama's problem was never with the women; it was with the men.
Well, you mean the white working class?
The fabled white working class.
The fabled, right? But these are said to be two separate issues. I mean, there's the hardcore Hillary advocates per se, and they're the ones who are invoked when people say, well, he may need a woman on the ticket or Hillary on the ticket. And then there's the white working class issue, which I think is largely separate.
Right, but you're the one who brought up Hillary. I didn't bring up Hillary. I don't think the Hillary supporters not voting for Obama is a problem. So,
well, okay, but you are hearing the argument, are you not, that he needs a woman on the ticket or something?
I'm hearing that argument. The scariest possibility that I hear a lot, and it's mainly from women, is that he should have Chuck Hagel on the ticket. And you know,
that's nuts.
He's incoherent. Women just like him because he's good looking.
Now, that's nuts. I mean, Jim Webb is an interesting proposition. Chuck Hagel is.
Do we want to elaborate?
I don't think a serious.
Do we want to elaborate why it's nuts? I mean, it's nuts because he had the exact wrong position on Iraq. He voted for the war, and then he started pissing on the surge. The surge has worked. The war was a stupid idea, so he got both of them wrong. He seems depressive. He can hardly get out a coherent sentence when he makes an argument against the Iraq war. It's not a coherent argument like Obama's. It's just sort of some sort of inside the beltway rant. I mean, I don't understand what the guy's appeal is other than that he's a babe.
Well, I hadn't heard anybody arguing the case for him as vice president, and I would not embrace it. I do regret that Hagel didn't run as president on the Republican side just so that the traditional, a traditional component of the foreign policy part of the Republican Party, that is to say, you know, realists, basically, had no viable representation. They had kind of Ron Paul, but, you know, he's kind of loopy. So I would have liked to have seen the Republican Party have a chance to express a sensible position on foreign policy in the primary, but they didn't.
Okay, anyway, we've dispensed with... I just think this Hillary women thing is a straw woman.
Okay, but it's being said a lot more than this Hagel for vice president stuff is being said.
Well, you
so anyway, but we've dispensed with both of them.
That's right. You don't talk to the Central West Side Los Angeles party insiders like I do.
And who are these people?
I don't know. Bunch of my
friends. Ariana Huffington?
No, I haven't talked to her about it. We were going to talk about...
We're going to talk about McCain. Okay, so
yeah.
You're saying... What's your line about...
My line is McCain really is a maverick. Ariana's book is misguided when she tries to portray him as having abandoned his maverickness. The classic example is, yes, immigration reform, where He mouthed what he had to mouth during the campaign about securing the borders first. He's already backtracked on them and declared he wants to pursue comprehensive immigration reform, which is exactly the position that enraged the right. He just isn't a doctrinaire right-wing conservative, and he seems to feel, probably rightly, that the Republican Party is in such terrible shape that they will swallow that, even to the point of him, you know, saying, ha ha, I fooled you on immigration. I really am for comprehensive.
Wait, he thinks who will swallow what?
He thinks the Republic. He hasn't been through the convention yet. Usually you don't start tacking to the center until after the convention. He's already tacking to the center on a bunch of issues, and he's assuming that the convention will swallow it. They won't revolt in anger that he's abandoning conservative principles because they're so desperate, they're in such bad shape. And I think that's right. I think that calculation is correct.
Okay.
That was my point.
So you think he's doing the smart thing?
Yeah, on foreign policy, he seems to have moved to the left on Russia and to the right on Korea. So he's sending mixed signals, and my interpretation of that is it's all politics. He just wants to, it's not a substantive Fred Kaplan a piece in Slate about how he's been captured by the neocons on Korea. I just think he wants to take advantage of Obama's pledge to meet with anybody, and he wants to hang that around Obama's neck. And one way to hang that around Obama's neck is to say, you know, Kim Il-jong is a horrible dictator. We don't want to meet with him. We want to do all sorts of things that are unobtainable, but we can posture until the election and pretend that, you know, we can get all this stuff from Kim Il-jong without meeting with him. I saw that as a completely political document. It does not mean he's been captured by the neocons. It means he's been captured by stupid campaign advisors who think that they can beat Obama with this.
Well, but I haven't seen the evidence that he really hasn't been captured by the neocons.
Well,
I mean,
with the Russian thing wasn't a neocon position, was it?
Let's talk about the Russian thing. So you're talking about two kind of seemingly contradictory headlines about McCain very recently.
Correct.
One is from the Washington Post by Glenn Kessler. McCain breaks with Bush over North Korea, and there he seemed to move to the right, to the neocon tradition.
And there's also a Fred Kaplan piece in Slate on that.
Okay, and then another headline, McCain vows to work with Russia on arms. This is yesterday, and you'd think the lead is exactly what he'd want for political purposes, where it says Senator John McCain, blah, blah, distanced himself from the Bush administration on Tuesday by vowing to work more closely with Russia on nuclear disarmament.
Right.
So there he seems to be moving to the left and disassociating himself with the Bush policy.
Correct.
But, I mean, there are some problems here. First of all, there is, it seems to me, an ideological explanation for the discrepancy. If you look at the policy of Bush's that he's breaking with on the right, that he's breaking with on Russia, okay, first of all, it is actually a kind of older, it's a farther to the right policy than the part of Bush that he's breaking with on North Korea. So he's actually moving right from a leftish policy, or at least centrist, and moving slightly left, although not in an especially meaningful way, I think, from a right-wing policy, okay, that was really a leftover from the early part of Bush's administration. This is a Russian policy. Is more of like a leftover from years and years ago.
What is the right-wing Russian policy he's moving away from that you would...
It was something about refusing to do symmetrical verification. It was some Bolton-esque refusal to just do an arms deal, you know. I don't know the details, but basically that's a holdover from early Bush that just the Bush administration hadn't bothered to revisit. And that was a time back when their North Korea policy was also right-wing. But since North Korea is a simmering issue, they have, as the neocons have left the administration, Bush has moved to the center on North Korea. And that's that. And so when McCain takes issue, what I'm saying is McCain can move to the right of Bush on North Korea, a little to the left on Russia, and be in the same place. And that's a consistent position.
Well, his position seems to be he's willing to negotiate with non-rogue nations like Russia, and he takes a hard line on rogue nations like. But I think that second half is political. The hard line with rogue nations like North Korea and Iran is how he hopes to score political points against Obama.
Actually, I think the Russia thing is more is in a way more political, for the following reason. I think the North Korea thing. he may think it's politically convenient, and he may be right, but I also think that reflects the actual ideology of a lot of his advisors who are neocons.
Kaplan was convincing that it was a crazy policy. He wasn't convincing that it was McCain's sincere policy, and you say it really is.
I think he may see it as both, but it's a neocon type of policy. He has always had neocon supporters and champions and advisors, so it's not like you need to reach for a political explanation of it. And the other reason I would say that you shouldn't see the Russia thing as representing the true apolitical McCain is it is quite conspicuously at odds with a pronouncement of his only a little bit a month or so ago, I guess, maybe 2 months. But and this was actually noted in a New York Times piece. I was impressed that they picked up on this. Not so long ago, McCain said Russia should be kicked out of the G8. And at the time, Fareed Zakaria wrote, I think, an under-publicized column in which he said, it is a sign of what is wrong with foreign policy debate that this idea... his point is that the fact that this proposal is barely registered on the zeitgeist, the idea of kicking Russia out of the G8, is a sign of how screwed up our discourse is on foreign policy. You know, we're focused on whether, this is what he says, we're focused on whether Obama would meet with Iran, whether he'd meet with Venezuela. And here, McCain proposes something truly radical. And in the eyes of many, many people on left and right, I think, crazy, right? Do we need to pick a fight with Russia right now by kicking them out of the G8? And that is true. That is pure neocon, okay? I think that's the real McCain. And by the way, the idea, it rather undermines the idea that he could seriously now approach Russia about arms control, right? Okay, first he's going to say, we're kicking you out of the G8. And then he's going to say, let's do a deal on arms control after humiliating them? No way. That's crazy.
The issue is, what is the real McCain? I agree. Imagine McCain is president, okay? He proposes kicking Russia out of the G8. There'll be a media, firestorm among people like Fareed Zakaria and the top 100 public intellectuals. And they will pressure McCain. He's very sensitive to what the press and people in policy elites think of him. And... It seems clear to me that McCain will not pursue that when he's president.
Why is he doing it? Does he think this is a political winner to say let's kick Russia out of the G8?
Doesn't he sort of have to keep all the various foreign policy factions in the Republican Party happy at least until November?
To me, this sounds like the true McCain. I mean, the McCain of the advisory structure he surrounded himself with.
Here are the advisors listed in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Kissinger, John Lehman, James Woolsey. I don't think those are neocons, are they?
Well, Woolsey is the functional equivalent of a neocon, yes. And by the way, what they list those as, those are people who he consulted with on the speech about the arms control proposal with Russia, which was kind of centrist, okay? They didn't say these are ongoing McCain advisors.
That's true. And one of them is Bolton and one of them is Kagan. So I guess you get those.
Although Bob Kagan is one of the more, as people labeled neocons go, he's relatively reasonable. But yeah, he wrote some of the founding doctrines of neocon foreign policy.
Well, anyway, my general perspective on McCain is that he deeply values his media base, and that will temper his conservatism in office. Yet another reason why. The attempt to paint him as this hardcore right winger is wrong.
Well, in any event, let me tell you. You know, I promised last week to, for the next few weeks, propose a vertebrae of the week for Barack Obama. The idea being that he needed to put some spine in his foreign policy rhetoric. I didn't mean sound hawkish. I meant sounding like he had the courage of his convictions in a sensible foreign policy, right?
People were very excited about this new feature, yeah.
Well, here we go. He should focus at length on this one thing. McCain wants to kick Russia out of the G8, okay? And And what he should say is, you know, a lot of people, including me, have suggested that McCain is just more Bush. Actually, he's worse than that, okay? Bush, at his worst, I don't think proposed anything this crazy. And foreign policy thinkers, most, I think, on the left and most on the right, think this is crazy. And this is much closer to the worst part of the Bush administration, which is the early part, ideologically. You know, McCain's got some explaining to do. A, what good does it do? B, how does he then turn around and propose this arms control and do this arms control thing he's talking about with Russia? C, if he's serious about solving the Iranian problem, okay, and he wants to do anything other than just start by bombing them and might want to try to step up sanctions, for example, isn't this going to make it a little harder to keep Russia on board? With the sanctions?
I assume the answer to your question B is, if you actually want to negotiate with them, you need a stick, and the stick is the G8. And, you know,
if you want to negotiate with who?
With Russia, then you need leverage. And so you take a hawkish, you take a right-wing position on kicking them out of the G8, but you'll give that up if they'll go along with you on other things, including arms control and including raiding in Iran. So it makes sense. Sort of from a leverage.
Well, first of all, I don't think his proposal is that you threaten. His proposal, I think, is you do it. And then you let, like, India and someone else into the G8, and you don't let China in. So, see, this is, again, pure neocon. Deepen the gulf between us and China. Deepen the gulf between us and Russia. And I don't see how it helps. And it exhibits such, you know, obliviousness to the actual constraints that operate on politicians. I mean, if you humiliate Putin in front of his people, if you diss him big time in front of his people, he cannot afford as a political matter, even though Russia is far from a pure democracy, right? He still wants as much allegiance from his people as he can get. He simply cannot afford at that point to turn around and seem to do America's bidding on anything, on Iran or anything else.
Here's a question. Why do the neocons take an adversarial position to Russia? I understand why they might towards China and North Korea, but I don't understand why didn't they claim to have won the Cold War? So if they've won the Cold War, why do we need to take an attitude toward Putin that is similar to the attitude we took to Brezhnev? Why is that part of neocon doctrine?
They have this idea that we should pay tremendous attention to the degree of democracy and respect for human rights within countries, and if they are not on our page, then we shouldn't really do business with them. And this gets us back to the concert of democracies idea, this neocon idea that you should start this whole new body. In fact, in a way, McCain's G8 proposal is another kind of backdoor to something like the concert of democracies, where you start kicking out the non-democracies and letting in some democracies.
Right.
And it's a you know, meaningful institution. They have this general bias in favor of keeping countries that don't meet our standards of democracy and human rights out of influential international institutions. So that would be China, Russia, and, you know, let's face it, you just can't solve the world's problems, including keeping Iran from going nuclear, if you gratuitously gratuitously disrespect countries like that. It's nuts.
Okay, you've convinced me that McCain might be more of a neocon on foreign policy than I thought. I know nothing about foreign policy. I hope Ariana wrote about that in her book, because that sort of makes sense.
I want to quickly add that there's a problem with Obama exercising the talking point I just suggested if certain advisors in his own camp hold sway, and that is that some of them support the concert for democracies, because there are some liberal humanitarian interventionists who like it, along with the neocons, in other words, exactly the same coalition that brought us the Iraq War, supports the concert of democracies. And there are several people in his camp. I think Ivo Dalder's in his camp and likes the idea. I think Tony Lake probably likes the idea and is definitely in his camp. And the jury's out. I mean, some people I know are worried that Obama may stumble into support for the concert of democracies, because when you first hear it seems like it makes sense, and he's not all that well grounded in foreign policy. But the fact is, if he buys into that, he's going to give up a major talking point that he could use against McCain, which is, for example, kicking Russia out of the G8 is stupid.
We've talked about this before. I claim the concept of democracies has something good going for it, which is that countries will try to get in the way they try to get in the WTO, and you claim, well, there's short-term benefits to getting in the WTO that don't exist with the concept of democracies, so the situations aren't parallel.
Right. That we covered last time.
I just thought we'd recap that.
Right.
For first-time viewers.
I've done a lot of talking, so you should, vent your spleen or something.
No,
for a while.
I'm just here to listen, Bob, and learn. You know that.
Okay.
The only other thing I have to talk about McCain is this interesting article by Yuval Levin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that, in the Weekly Standard, trying to give theme to McCain's pudding. And the theme he hits on is institutional reform of all sorts of government institutions that have broken down and haven't kept pace with changing times, including the healthcare system, the Medicare system, Social Security, housing market, of course, immigration, although he soft-pedals immigration, targeted choice for schools. It does a pretty good job of giving McCain some sort of theme to run on. The couple of problems are, first, some of McCain's proposed reforms are misguided, like immigration. Second, they're all market-oriented, so they don't ultimately address a couple of problems. I hesitate to say that I agree with Ezra Klein that they don't address the healthcare problem. Ezra Klein had a big debate with Andrew Sullivan on this subject. And in general, if you defer to the market for everything, you don't do anything about the problem of social inequality. So the third problem, which a lot of conservatives on the corner have pointed out, is that once you start reforming institutions to fix problems, you're on a slippery slope to liberalism. Because what if, the healthcare system you devise doesn't, in fact, guarantee affordable coverage to people, or winds up denying people life-saving treatments in the name of cost containment? Then you wind up spending a lot more of the public's money. But I recommend this article.
And is there something that you would do that about social inequality that McCain in this scenario would not be doing?
Well, sure. I like Medicare. I like Medicare the way it is now. I like Medicare because it gets everybody from all different classes in the same actual waiting room, seeing the same doctors. And I think that's a powerful reinforcer of social equality in a way that mailing everybody checks is not a reinforcer of social equality.
So are you? What do you think of the Obama?
I would sacrifice some cost containment in order to have medical care be a sphere of solidarity.
Now, am I right to think, along with a lot of people, I think, that Obama just has a clear edge over McCain politically on the health care thing?
Yes. Although this guy, Yuval Levin, claims that McCain's speech was the best Republican speech on health care yet, and also claims that the market sort of forces that Bush introduced in his prescription drug package actually work to reduce costs and could be applied on a wider basis to the entire Medicare system. And my impression is that they have worked, but I also question whether you could apply them to the entire Medicare system.
And can you save me some reading time that I still haven't figured this out? In a nutshell, what is Obama's health care plan?
I can't.
You can't? Not even... I know you know more than I do about this.
I think they all let people buy into something that's very much like the government, the government's health care plan, and they both subsidize the poor, so it's all affordable, but in theory, but Obama doesn't have a mandate. That's all I know.
Well, he doesn't have a mandate, but what he does for someone like me, for example, if I don't have health care... but I'm not poor, at least not at the moment, is what? He gives me this one government-like program that I can...
No, the government, it's a menu of, qualifying plans, and you could pick one of them. I assume that on some sort of sliding scale you would be subsidized. You've tapped into an area of limited knowledge on my part.
Wow. I didn't mean to embarrass and humiliate you and possibly end your career in journalism, but I think I have.
Well, I think I probably dropped out of the top 10 million public intellectuals with this performance. But, you know, I defer to Jonathan Cohn. There are four or five ways to do it. Obama's and Hillary's plans are both fine. They don't necessarily reflect what's actually going to happen once legislation starts going down the pike in Congress, so why spend a lot of effort now trying to compare their plans? And, you know, the main danger is, and this has come out also recently in the blogosphere, there are all these Democratic senators running around saying, well, we won't necessarily be able to do very much with our limited resources in the, you know, the first few years. We can at least hold hearings and advance the debate, i.e. they're backing off actually doing something. And it seems, I buy the 100 days model. I think if you get elected president, you have about 6 months to 2 years to actually do something while you have a head of steam. If you don't push health care through then, it's very hard to push it through later.
I am totally on board. I want health care legislation soon for my own purposes. But it does seem that
well,
Obama
does,
is.
But that's interesting. Why? How does it affect you? Because you're a freelancer and you need to get out of some plan, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story. I have been freeloading on one institution, and that may not last, basically.
Right.
But it's not Blogging Heads, God knows.
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
And then I would have another 18 months under COBRA or whatever to pay for my own before I got completely cast out to sea. Right. But anyway, I guess Obama is in this score in better shape than Hillary would be, right? Because his plan is somewhat to the right of hers, at least in the sense that it isn't compulsory and can not so easily be depicted as coercive and so on. You'd rather, if you're the Democrat running, you'd probably rather have Obama's plan than Hillary's, right?
It's in terms of the raw politics, that's possibly true, although, Hillary has a very good policy argument that you do have to penalize the freeloaders somehow. So that's a point that Paul Krugman has been beating to death. But, I guess that's right. I mean, on the other hand, the anti-mandatory position is for some reason endorsed by a lot of labor unions who fear that, it's not clear that it's a, quote, right-wing position, but the public doesn't know that, so.
Okay. So what else do we have to talk about?
I don't think we have all that much to talk about. And I wanted to keep it under half an hour, which we failed to do. There's a column by Jake Tapper about how Obama's a gaffomatic.
I thought that was pretty stupid. Did you read that?
It was weaker than I thought, in part because it makes a big deal of his supposed gaffes about FARC.
Exactly.
And Chavez.
Exactly.
And how
that's almost the whole piece.
And how it's a contradiction for Obama to say he's going to talk to Chavez and yet isolate him. And I just
right.
don't see that as such a contradiction.
No,
isolate him, then you go talk to him and say, hey, buddy, we've isolated you.
Right.
If you want to come unisolated, you got to do X, Y, and Z.
No, and the other big contradiction he claims to see is that at one point Obama says things he would discuss with Chavez is his support of FARC in Colombia, that is the rebel movement in Colombia, as if Obama seems to know that Chavez is supporting them. And then in another formulation, Obama says, if Venezuela has violated these rules, including, support for FARC, we should mobilize all the countries to sanction. So in one case, he's being kind of legalistic about it and saying,
right.
assuming he's, in another case, he's kind of implying that he knows the guy's guilty. That's just the way people talk. I mean,
no,
that's just not a big deal.
I agree with that. On the other hand,
it's silly.
He's made a series of petty, bizarre glitches that if McCain made them, we'd say, and this is a point that right-wingers like Brent Frazel make, we would say, McCain's having a senior moment, he's too old. He talked about the 57 states, he talked about the fallen in battle being in the audience, this bizarre thing about how Hillary's closer to Kentucky than my state, There have been about, you know, four or five of them.
I don't think the last would get traction with anybody. And you're saying if McCain, I mean, Obama apparently at one point said, I've been to all 57 states. You're saying if McCain had said that, it would be like 3 days of news about signs of senility or something?
Yeah. And there was a final one which was confusing Auschwitz and Buchenwald, which is trivial, you know, in terms of his fitness for office. But if McCain said it again, it would be a big story for a day.
Yeah. Now that was more in the Hillary Tuzla line of mistakes, which is this is a story he had been telling about a relative, and I think he had been incrementally making it more dramatic over the years. And so this granduncle or great uncle became an uncle, and
right.
Buchenwald became Auschwitz, and
right. Well,
I think that was that order mistake.
Is Auschwitz that much worse than Buchenwald?
Well, it's just more famous. I don't know what the relative magnitude is, but it's that would be an easy mistake to make, you know, over the years, unless you were quite conversant. But I think it's true. But I think if it's true that McCain would be penalized more for casual errors, it's not so much a left-right bias as an age bias. I mean, I remember, you know, when Bob Dole was running for president and he got mixed up and called the Los Angeles Dodgers the Brooklyn Dodgers, everybody was like, oh, he's over the hill, you know. But that's just, you know, I mean, I thought that was totally not a big deal. After all, Bob Dole was an adult when they were the Brooklyn Dodgers. It's not a case of senility necessarily, an example of senility to use that formulation, but they made a huge deal of it.
I think it's all three. It's an age bias, it's a partisan bias, and it's a bending over backwards not to tarnish the first credible black candidate for president bias, who was president of the Harvard Law Review. So there's a fourth bias, which is it doesn't fit with the pre-existing paradigm of what people think of Obama.
Well, I don't so much. I think for a while in the early part of the primary, Obama was getting kind of a free ride. I think that ended, at least relative to Hillary. And I guess now a new dynamic sets in because it's Obama versus McCain. And you may turn out to be right. I don't know.
It'll sort of end because when it's one-on-one, him and McCain, the press corps can't entirely cover for him. There'll be enough of the press corps that will hammer him for his mistakes.
Yeah.
I think the free ride is ending for him.
Now, I was going to complain briefly about this immigration crackdown.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Now, first of all, what are the details? I mean, to what...
You were the one that brought it up.
Well, there's been more and more coverage of an immigration crackdown emanating from the federal level, although it can also happen autonomously at the, like, local or state level, I guess, right?
Right, there are a couple of states that have passed very tough laws, like Arizona, for example.
But like yesterday's Los Angeles Times, in an ongoing push to deport immigration violators, federal officers have arrested
right.
more than 300 immigrants in the Los Angeles area in the last 3 weeks, blah, blah, blah. My position, and in some other article, it was depicted very kind of straightforwardly as the Bush administration, perhaps, I don't know, with an eye to helping McCain or not, but wanted to move in this direction on immigration and be seen as tough. I just think it's really, really despicable for reasons I can articulate, if that's the case.
Were they just picking up people who have their only crime was being in the country illegally, or were they picking up people who had criminal records or were violated a court order? There's a big difference.
Well, it says, most of whom committed crimes, ignored deportation orders, or returned to the U.S. after being removed. So most of whom.
So those are not just 300 random illegals who are working diligently in sweatshops. There are 300... random illegals who have committed crimes or we have a special reason to want to arrest them. So why is that
okay.
so horrible and cruel?
Okay, but wait. According to the executive director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, Angelica Salas, who I'm sure is a good friend of yours, in many instances they don't get the people they are after, that they are looking for. So one of the things they do to up their numbers is arrest bystanders.
Right.
I mean, not any bystander, but bystanders who are illegal immigrants. Now, that does not seem implausible to me. I know the way these things work, you know, these body count things. Cops have to get their quota on speeding tickets, whatever.
Well, but
that does not seem implausible to
me. That's a run-of-the-mill complaining assault police action. If you if you had that objection, you would never have the police do anything. They're a big bureaucracy, and they run stupid numbers.
I think as a taxpaying citizen, I can ask that the police enforce the law in a way that we consider just and equitable.
I agree, but that doesn't mean you stop giving out speeding tickets. The point is that people who have my position on immigration, which is we're very skeptical of comprehensive immigration reform, we want to secure the borders before we have any sort of amnesty for existing illegals, because that would otherwise send the wrong signal, are very skeptical of this crackdown. We think Bush is probably doing it as harshly as possible in order to encourage a backlash, because Bush wants comprehensive reform. And if you do it harshly, you do a couple of things. You make it seem like amnesty is the only solution, only humane solution, and you get the companies really pissed off, so they start lobbying Washington for amnesty. And as John O'Sullivan put it, Bush wants to give the right what it wants, good and hard. The idea is being to be as mean as possible. That seems
more conspiracy theoretical than you normally get.
It's not at all conspiracy. Bush has said a couple of things that imply that this is exactly his strategy about how.
Like what?
Well, he says like in a few months you're going to see employers complaining about crops rotting in the fields, and there's going to be a backlash. That implies he knows that he might be generating a backlash. It seems to me the answer is you screen new employees. You don't go after existing employees. Of course you go after the ones that have a criminal record, and if the police are irresponsible on arrest bystanders, you stop them from doing that. It doesn't mean you don't go after the criminals. But you focus on new employees, not people who are currently just here working illegally. You don't roust them out of their homes. So that has the effect of locking those existing employees into their current jobs, but that is a relatively minor problem compared with rousting them out of their homes for their current jobs.
So we agree that it's not right to arrest people whose only crime is having come across the border, illegally, but at a time when we were just nodding and winking
come on over.
I'm
not going to let you get away with that, because in 1986, we passed an immigration reform, the point of which was, okay, we'll give amnesty to all the card ones, but this time we're serious, don't cross the border.
Year?
Since 86 immigration
86?
Reform under Reagan.
A lot of these people weren't alive in 86, Mickey.
But the point is, we had a policy which says, okay, this is enough, this time we're serious.
No, we didn't. We had a law that was not enforced.
This idea that we were nodding and winking after 86, which I let you get away with before, you should not be able to get away with.
No, we were.
In 86, we did exactly what we were supposed to do now, which is we give amnesty and say, okay, now we're going to secure the border. The fact that we didn't secure the border doesn't mean that immigrants weren't on some sort of constructive notice, that they were here illegally, and, hey, if you're in a country illegally, they might just kick you out.
They're supposed to pore over the congressional record rather than what I would expect in this situation, which is that they listen to what their cousins who have already gone over say, which is, hey, listen, the deal is technically what you're doing is illegal. I grant that they knew it was technically illegal, but the point is their cousin is telling them, you get over here, there's no problem, the Americans want you here to do their gardening, to paint their houses, it's fine. And that was true for years and years and years, and we were nodding and winking. Let me just finish, Mickey. And it is immoral now to turn around and say and start arresting them, and it's particularly immoral because, the people are it's hard for them to get out of this situation, right? It's not like, I mean, I'll give you an analogy. When I went to college, when you went to college, the more or less official position on things like marijuana was, well, you can do them in your room, blah blah blah. We're not out to get you. Now, if they had suddenly cracked down, I'd say fine. So they arrest a few, and then everybody else knows you better get rid of it, But in this case, these guys can't, they're stuck. It's not easy for them. I mean, their families are dependent on these jobs. It's not easy for them to go back across the border. So I just think this is deeply, deeply immoral to do this, particularly for political purposes as it's being done.
Why wouldn't the political purpose is to pass comprehensive immigration reform? Won't exactly the same dynamic happen after comprehensive immigration reform is passed? In other words, some people will still cross the border illegally because their cousins tell them, okay, these people want you to water their lawns. They'll be here for 4 or 5 years. Then after this allegedly tough comprehensive law has passed, people like you will say, oh, no, we can't deport them.
No. If they enforce it from the beginning, that's a different story. Then they are legitimately on notice. But for you to look back to a law passed in 86 and saying, why didn't this guy who came over in 2007 know that he was put on notice in 86 by a law that was never enforced? I mean, come on.
Well, the law was actively undermined by the ACLU and
I don't care who undermined it, Mickey. We're talking about the morality of enforcing.
You're saying if they succeed in undermining the next law, that it's immoral for the government to ever then later crack down because they succeeded in undermining it. You're just on a slippery slope toward never being able to enforce immigration laws. It's not that hard for people to go back across the border. They're doing it in droves. And if you apply the policy humanely, you know, they'll, when the school year is up, they'll decide, hey, you know, it's not so comfortable working here illegally in California. The Mexican economy is booming. Maybe I should go back home. That's sort of what's happening.
In the end, having failed to sway you with my rigorous and inexorable logic, I would just say, try to put yourself in the position of millions and millions of people who are reading these headlines now. They're in the country. They thought they were kind of accepted and more or less appreciated. And now all of a sudden, they're deeply worried and they're wondering, can I go to the store and blah, blah, blah. There's millions of people in that position in the country right now. Just stop and try to put yourself in their shoes and then repeat to me what you seem to be saying, which is this policy's fine and is not immoral at all.
Well, the headline itself is irrelevant. The headline itself sends a signal that, you know, yes, we are cracking down. That's the signal you supposedly want the new law to send. And then those people aren't rousted from their homes, but they can wind up their affairs and decide for themselves whether they want to go back or not. And that's a relatively humane way
to
enforce the
laws.
In theory, that's how you would have the comprehensive reform that you apparently want operate. Having a demonstration effect is very bad for the people on whom it's being demonstrated, i.e. the people who were taken from their homes and deported, but it's a relatively humane way to send a signal to the people who aren't that, hey, you know, maybe you should think about that the situation has changed.
You're saying what's happening now, before any law is passed, is a humane way to send a signal?
The laws are passed, they're just enforcing the laws on the books, Bob.
Yeah, but I thought you were talking about a signal that would be sent by comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, the way
to
do this...
Right, that'll be more laws, and then I also have the choice as to whether to enforce them. And if we enforce them, that'll send
a
signal
to the
people who come across the border illegally after the date of whatever the amnesty comes.
It is just not moral to instill fear in a whole bunch of people who came across at a time when the de facto policy was welcome aboard. That's just not moral.
After 86, the de facto policy was not welcome aboard.
We've talked about this. I mean, what a nutty argument that somebody who came over last year, after two successive decades of not enforcing the law, was supposed to go, well, maybe they meant business. Mickey, I'm not denying that they know that it's illegal. Of course, there's a reason they call it illegal immigration.
Well,
I realize it was technically illegal.
So they know they're illegal. What's the problem?
And so you really... This has no effect on you whatsoever to try to get you to imagine yourself in the shoes of all of these millions of people in America right now. It just doesn't faze you.
It seems to me that both of us have the problem of if you're not for open borders, you have to draw the line somewhere. How do you enforce that line? You want to enforce the line as humanely as possible.
One
way you do it is by arresting people who cross the line and having that be a demonstration effect to the millions of people who have crossed the line and haven't been busted yet. And that is a relatively humane way to enforce the law.
No, you want to know a humane way?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, here it is. You pass a whole new law. You know, you do this comprehensive immigration reform, and there's a lot of publicity about it, and you say we're going to enforce it from day one. If you come over the border after this, you're in this special category, it's very risky, and you actually do that from day one. That would be humane.
But millions of people
You don't suddenly decide to enforce a law that's been ignored for two decades.
That's exactly what was said in 86. B, millions of people will cross the border after that. What do you do about them? They're here. They have families. They have children. It's under,
right.
You can't roust them from their homes. What if they
right.
What if they manage to stay here for 2 years? Do they then get in and get amnesty too? So you have succeeding amnesties ad infinitum on into the future?
No, what I'm saying is if you enforce it from the moment it's passed, that's one thing.
But
and again,
like
this
me,
is different.
People,
this is different like, from so many laws where if you suddenly enforce a law, a speeding law, or anything, and people can see the signal sent and go, okay, I won't do that anymore. These people aren't positioned to say, I won't do that anymore. They're here illegally.
They're
Some
totally,
of them are in the north. They would just
totally,
getting back to the.
They're totally aware that they're here illegally, and
I know that,
and that this could happen at any time. So I don't see where their
situation totally
is
up.
All that different from the people who will be here illegally after comprehensive immigration reform is passed, and we say for the third or fourth time, we're serious this time. You're still
okay.
going to have a problem of inhumanity if you enforce the law against people who disobey it.
Okay. I understand your position.
God, what a concession.
That's not meant to be a compliment, that I understand your position. But I understand it.
I
actually don't.
You,
but anyway, I'm willing to say that if we can quit talking about it.
You claim to be a utilitarian. You don't accept the position that sometimes you could do something that's very harmful to an individual, yet it will have vast, broader consequences that in the utilitarian calculus will be a big net positive.
Sometimes you can do that.
I mean, it's hard. It was very hard with welfare reform to say, hey, you're a mother with a single child, you're poor,
right.
We're going to cut you off welfare. That's very bad for that woman, yet it sends a very positive signal to all the other women who might be thinking of going on welfare.
Right.
So the same thing with this.
Well, I can't bring myself to argue anymore. I think I've been completely clear about the legitimately utilitarian approach. And, I mean, first of all, when you do something that massively degrades the quality of life of millions of people in America, which I think this does, I, as a utilitarian, don't exactly have my back against the wall trying to explain why I'm against it, okay? The ball's in your court. You know, what good does it do? I mean, you know that nothing serious is going to happen on immigration until we pass a whole new law anyway. So why cause all this suffering in advance of that?
I suspect the Bush administration of causing excessive suffering. I agree. I would like to secure the borders first, make sure the ACLU doesn't undermine it, and then, as we've talked about, all sorts of things are possible with people who are here. But so I would favor, both you and I would favor focusing on the prospective enforcement of the law, as opposed to rousting people out of their homes. All I'm saying is there's going to be a certain amount of rousting people out of their homes under any regime, and if you, flinch about that, you're going to end up with what, has happened in Europe, which is wave after wave of amnesty, then it's violated, then there's another amnesty, and as long as you're establishing the precedent that as long as you cross the border and establish facts on the ground in the United States, hey, it was a wink and a nod that it's okay.
Well, 15 minutes ago, I said I quickly wanted to say something about the immigration thing, and I guess 15 minutes is enough. As I said, I think I understand your position, although actually I'm just saying that so that we can quit talking about it.
I appreciate your sneering contempt, Bob.
Thank you. It's not something I bestow on just anyone.
Okay.
Only the people I love the most. So, anything else? I mean, I gave you the last word, man. What do you want?
I just don't like it when you get on this moral high horse. I think it's bullshit.
Okay, you win. I mean, it is a little bit of a high horse, it's true. There's a little bit of posturing. There's this much posturing, which is unnecessary since I do have the moral law of the universe on my side to begin with. I don't know why I do that.
Okay. I admire that admission.
Quickly, a couple things from commenters. Commenter Private Press asks, this is the Glenn Lowry, John McWhorter dialogue. His comment consists of this: whiskey ? Apple juice ? Mickey, what do you make of that?
Well, I see they were wondering what Lowry was drinking.
So you saw that part of it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. My message to Private Press is it would be a mistake to assume that everyone who comes across this comment knows that, so maybe you could provide a little dingle wink in the comment. And just by way of driving that home, I would like to talk about the glory that was bestowed on Baltimoreon because he did include a ding-a-link. And Mickey, you know what glory that was, right?
Well, I linked to it. I thought it was a good ding-a-link.
But you didn't just link to it. You credited him in your blog.
Well, that's
Baltimoreon got his username in your blog.
That's standard web etiquette. But he linked to the embedded link,
he linked to the embedder page. It's a long story.
And should people not link to the embedder page? They should actually link to the ding-a-link?
Well, it's a long story, which I'd prefer for my own self-serving corporate reasons, but it's a little bit of a curiosity how our commenters became aware of that page. It's a page that shows you how to embed any clip. But, you know, we should link to it and show people how wondrous it is that anyone, unlike the YouTube embedded player, Mickey, our embedded player lets you take any segment of a dialogue and embed it in your blog. Pick any end time, any out time, and do it.
And
this is the page that explains how, and I will link to it on the side.
And why wouldn't you want to publicize that? I think that'd be a good thing.
I do want to publicize it.
Okay.
I do want to publicize it.
Okay.
And that's... Then the only other comment I would talk about is, John McWhorter in that dialogue had used Pabst Blue Ribbon as what the kind of stereotypical white working class Obama opponent voter would drink.
Right.
Threep writes, guys, PBR, meaning Pabst Blue Ribbon, is for white hipsters, not white hicks. Did you know that?
Well, I think didn't it start off as being for white hicks and then and then it failed, and then it was adopted by white hipsters because they thought that's what white hicks drink?
Do you know what I think the turning point was?
It's like the trucker hat of beers.
Do you know when I think this happened, the pivot point in American cultural history?
I didn't know that. When?
My theory is it's a moment in the movie Blue Velvet when Dennis Hopper says something I can't repeat on the air. I'll repeat a cleaner version
about
of it.
About Pabst Blue Ribbon?
Yeah, the line is... Heineken, I'll say, screw that crap, not exactly what he said, Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Huh.
I maintain that may be the turning point.
Well, I know you're a Blue Velvet obsessive. Do you know what the most starving fact about Dennis Hopper is?
Long, pretty big menu there. What is it?
He's a Republican.
Well, you know, David Lynch was a Reagan supporter. But now David, the director of Blue Velvet, but David Lynch is now this transcendental meditation groupie. It's hard to believe he's a Bush supporter, but who knows? I didn't know that about Hopper.
Well,
that's kind of creepy.
Well, it's even weirder because his wife is a big Democrat, but there you go.
Now, you know what? The other final piece of trivia about Blue Velvet, we'll get out in under an hour, which means quick, but... Supposedly, there was actually another song, not Blue Velvet, that David Lynch was trying to get the rights to. And if he had gotten them, the movie would be named that. And David Lynch, I think, has never revealed this. But if any of our commenters know or have a guess...
Oh, you don't know the song?
No, David Lynch has never revealed what it is. He's conceded that this is true.
Huh.
That he was looking... He was trying to get the rights to another song, and that presumably would have been the movie's title.
Makes you sort of want to capture him and apply Gitmo techniques to get it out of him.
Or just get him on Blogging Heads and use my subtle persuasive technique, the thing that always changes your mind on issues.
You might be able to get him on Blogging Heads. He does the weather for a local radio station.
I think I resent that.
No, I mean, he's not averse to exposing himself in public.
Yeah, like low-rent venues is what you're saying, right?
Well, this is like such a low-rent venue that it's a high-concept venue, so...
I think I still resent that, but we only have 90 seconds to get out in under an hour. We meant to get out way sooner.
Okay.
Sorry, we apologize.
Yeah, you could be the Pabst Blue Ribbon of blog videos. Play your cards.
I'd settle for that. That's arguably a better business model than, never mind. Okay.
Okay.
See you around.
Yep, see ya.